Premier League football is back, but more importantly, so is the Squawker Talker football podcast. This episode, the first in 6 months, is a 2020-21 season preview special sponsored by William Hill. Download the William Hill app to put the world of betting at your fingertips, all in one place. In this episode, we chat about whether Liverpool can retain their Premier League title and whether Chelsea can become the league's third dominant force. We also discuss the race for those lucrative Champions League spots, including some dark horses that could be fighting for a place in Europe's elite club competition. The relegation battle features as well as a debate about whether Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds United side are the real deal, before rattling off some quickfire predictions for the Golden Boot, Golden Glove, Playmaker Award and PFA Player of the Season awards. All odds referenced are correct at the time of recording, which was the afternoon of Wednesday, 9th of September 2020. You must be 18 plus to place a bet, and for more information about responsible gambling, please visit begambleaware.org. Subscribers to the podcast, thank you for your patience in waiting for a new episode. And if this is your first listen of the Squawker Talker, I hope you enjoy. So as it's been 6 months since the last Squawker Talker recording, which is a crazy amount of time, I think it is worth reintroducing everyone, despite the guests on today's podcast being the usual suspects. My name is Jake Entwistle, if you didn't know that. I'm part of the Squawker social media team, and I'll be rambling and introducing everyone throughout the podcast. We are joined by Chief Editor at Squawker, Will Hall. Welcome. Hello. Back.
Wow. First Squawker Talker podcast introduction forever.
I know. And we have had, I was going to say, a lot of messages asking when the Squawker Talker is back, but
oh yeah, sorry.
Maybe that might be a bit of hyperbole. But people have missed us and we've missed doing it. Someone that has been desperate to do it again is chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Welcome back, Mo.
Thank you for having me, Jake. Mate, I've been keeping warm with the voice notes, but they just don't scratch the itch in the same way, do they? You've got to get the podcast goodness up, you know.
People were listening to those notes, though, as well, and asking for the podcast. So I think you whetted enough appetites with that. And the final guest on the 2020-21, that is a mouthful to say, Premier League preview, is content editor and or guru, depending on whether he wants to be called that or not, Mr. Sam Long. Welcome back, Sam.
Cheers, mate. How's it going?
It's going very well. I'm excited to be doing this again. So although you may have to forgive a bit of rustiness, we are going to get tucking straight in to the Premier League. And the best place to start is probably at the top of the table, and the fact that Liverpool finally ended their 30-year wait for a Premier League title. And only three teams have retained the Premier League title. That is Manchester City, Manchester United and Chelsea. But the odds on William Hill suggests that there will not be a fourth team, because at 2-1, Liverpool are second favourites. High-spending Chelsea are 11-1 in third, and Manchester United 14-1. So I'm going to come to you first, Will, on this. Why is it that after one of the most dominant seasons in the Premier League era, and perhaps the most dominant considering it was the earliest title win as well as being the latest, why is it that Liverpool are not favourites to retain the title, despite us addressing the fact that it is difficult to do?
Mostly because Man City are always favourites for everything at the start of every season, even the Champions League, because they have unrivaled squad depth and the best underlying metrics. For instance, they had the highest XG goal difference in the Premier League for last season, and I also think across Europe's top five leagues as well. There's also the fact they finished the league campaign strongly and were pretty much able to catch up with Liverpool's points per game output across 2020. So the numbers will probably be why bookmakers favour them. Whereas the popular opinion, which also seems to favour City, is, I think, influenced by having been underwhelmed, really, while watching Liverpool fail to become invincibles with the Watford defeat, treble winners by losing to Atletico Madrid, and Centurions right at the last hurdle when they lost to Arsenal. Looking ahead, though, the main question seems to be whether injuries and a lack of transfer business will expose a lack of squad depth at Liverpool. Some, and I know Mo is kind of in this camp, say they were lucky with injuries, not necessarily as something that tells the whole story of last season, but a contributing factor Liverpool might not necessarily be able to rely upon again. I think this overlooks a few things, though. Firstly, how lucky were they really? Because the Alisson injury is arguably what cost them a proper shot at the treble. If that Atletico Madrid fixture had just so happened to have been scheduled for the following week, this is the second leg, by the way, then it would have actually been played in August and he would have been in goal instead of Adrian. Henderson won the Football Writers Player of the Year award pretty much off the back of this perception that Liverpool are a worse team without him, and yet they still got by. Secondly, Liverpool actually have an injury-prone midfield of Fabinho, Henderson, Keita, Milner, Oxlade-Chamberlain and Wijnaldum. The only one who didn't get injured last season is the guy Liverpool might actually sell to Barcelona to sign Thiago, who is himself a player who missed about 10 games through injury last season. And finally, as much as you can say Liverpool are lucky because their important players are durable, equally true is that those players are important because they are durable. The front three rarely get injured, so their game time and rhythm allows them to sustain world-class reputations and world-class contributions season upon season. Conversely, and this goes back to the midfield thing, Keita could be one of the best midfielders in the Premier League if he hadn't kept hitting these injuries. He won possession in the final third more times than any Premier League player per 90 minutes last season. That's a player Liverpool would love to have and probably be a bit more important if he didn't keep having these fitness issues. It's also conceivable that part of why Liverpool funnel so much ball progression from fullback positions and also Van Dijk's long-range passing is because those guys are constantly available, whereas the midfield is not always relied upon to be fit. So they have been lucky in some areas. If they lost Sadio Mane and Mohamed Salah, then it's a big step down in quality on the wings. But they've also been unlucky in others, and they've just kind of played with what they've had. Because overall, Jurgen Klopp's adapted accordingly to great success. And so I think the squad depth issue is something that gets overplayed.
It's interesting there you say about the the injury-prone midfield roundabout that they've got going, whereas the front three's so consistent, Van Dijk's not injured. And I guess the arguments are that because they're used to their midfielders being injured, the rotation works. But we still haven't seen that Mohamed Salah injury, the Sadio Mane injury, even Roberto Firmino, who we always discuss as maybe being the most important out of those three. So in terms of that squad depth question, just to sort of stay on Liverpool a bit more, they finally got an Andy Robertson replacement, which was very much needed, in my opinion, because, again, if he was injured, they don't even have a left footer, really, that could have replaced him. Neco Williams looks like to be an able deputy for Alexander-Arnold, another academy product. But do you think Liverpool have enough if Mane got injured, if Salah got injured, if Firmino got injured? Or do you think that one of the most important stats in football that's often overlooked is appearances made and minutes played? Because we need to stand back and realise that if you're playing 38 games a season, you're doing something right.
Yeah, Robertson and Salah missed the 0-0 draw with Everton. After the restart, there was a draw with Manchester United not too long ago where we missed Salah, and he can be criticised for not stamping his presence onto games so much. When he's not there, you do miss him. Minamino's in good form in pre-season. It looks like he's an option to replace Firmino, so that's kind of boxed off. There seems to be a step down in quality out wide with Salah and Mane, but think about all the great moments Divock Origi's given the club. That 4-0 win over Barcelona, I think they were missing Salah and Firmino for that game. So arguably the greatest performance during Klopp's entire season, and he was without those two. So yeah, I think you can kind of rely on them to consistently play and say that it is a big issue if they lose them at the same time.
And with Van Dijk as well, Lovren leaving, despite him not having many fans among the Liverpool fan base, the centre-back depth, all of a sudden there's three centre-backs that are good, with Matip and Gomez again having that sort of unreliable injury proneness and swapping between the two. So again, it's all speculation in terms of if he gets injured, will they win? But a telling factor in the season may be the fitness of Van Dijk and Alisson as well, as you alluded to, those key defensive
I think in Fabinho they have another option for midfield, for central defence. You don't want to be in a position where you're having to play in defence, but I think if you get another midfielder in like Thiago, then it gives you enough midfield options to rely upon Fabinho as an option at centre-back as well.
Yeah, I think the other question for Liverpool really is one of desire, because I think at the moment, if I had to choose between Liverpool and Man City, if who was going to come back this season with more fire in their belly, I would say it was Man City at the moment. It reminded me of that classic marvellous Marvin Hagler quote, "It's hard to get up and do road work at 5 a.m. when you've been sleeping in silk pyjamas." And I think it's a bit of a case for that for Liverpool. Mm. The same as anyone who's defending a title, that the onus is on them now to take the initiative and really lead from the front, because I think Man City were really hurt last season.
So my question to you, Mo, we've had Will's argument why Liverpool maybe aren't considered favourites. And he also alluded to the fact that Man City are usually favourites because of their incredible attacking output. But last season was Pep Guardiola's worst season in terms of defeats in a single league campaign. Again, the attacking output was incredible, but the defence left a lot to be desired. Have they done enough in strengthening that defence to ensure that they are worthy of being considered favourites for the Premier League title this season?
Yeah and no. And Nathan Ake is a huge signing, because obviously, and when they signed him, everyone was laughing, "Oh, he's only won 40 whatever odd percent of his aerial duels. He's not good in the air." True, fine. But what Ake does have, which no one else in the Man City defence has apart from Kyle Walker, is recovery pace, is the ability to get back after someone's gotten in behind and make a tack or make a block. And that first team that plays basically on the halfway line, that's enormous. That's a huge thing that City need to have in their defence, and they don't have it. And it's a real problem. Eric Garcia looks phenomenal, phenomenally young defender, but he doesn't have an overabundance of recovery pace. Obviously, Laporte is on the slow side. I mean, who knows who's playing left back? None of them are particularly... Mendy has recovery pace, but he's usually like too far up the field to even make use of it. Walker's a good recovery base, but you know, so they need someone like Ake who can play instead of Laporte, can play with Laporte next to him, could play left back even, you know, frankly. He has the talent and the ability. Walker could play in a back three. He gives them so many options and tactical potential for growth, right, in terms of both the way the system, the way the team lines up, but also the way that they play, you know, the way that they recover. Even if they play the exact same system they played this season, sorry, last season, they won't, but let's say they did, he would slot into three positions in that team, and add so much. Now, if you talk about adding Kalidou Koulibaly, who is one of the five best centre-backs in the world, then, of course, you're talking about, okay, this is serious business now, because he is a defensive organiser. I mean, we've seen him for Napoli literally push teammates into the right position, where to stand. So he's a defensive organiser in the extreme, and he also has incredible technical ability to bring the ball out, so pass the ball from the back, which is what Pep wants. And what he has, what no City centre-back has had for years, really, is both power and pace and defensive instincts. So he's the perfect defender for City. He's the perfect defender for a lot of teams, you know, let's be fair. But for City in particular, what they need is they need someone who has that sort of Kompany-esque presence in the back line to command the back line, but they also then had... Kompany never had recovery pace himself, not really. So someone like Koulibaly would be transformative if they can get it across the line. But even if they don't get Koulibaly, look at how good their team is going forward. I mean, look at these numbers. Like, since Pep joined Man City, took over, 113 wins, that's the most in that time. 383 goals, that's the most in that time. 1,990 shots, 278 assists, that's the highest. 2,090 chances created, that's the highest. 379 big chances created, that's the highest. You know, the metrics go on, 103,856 passes, that's the highest. 67 clean sheets, that's also the highest, which is something you wouldn't associate with them. Edison, how should you put this? A goalkeeper that can do some very strange things, as we saw in the Champions League and their elimination, but over the course of a season, his ability with the ball and his ability to just make saves when he's called upon is very good. You know, City are just a phenomenal team, right? And also, by the way, they've got the player of the year, Kevin De Bruyne, who is, I mean, mind-bogglingly good. 20 assists last season, equal Thierry Henry's record. They've got Sergio Aguero, one of the most consistent strikers in the Premier League history. Bernardo Silva's a quality player. I mean, they've lost David Silva, so sure. But they've got Phil Foden coming into his own, Rodrigo, Gundogan. There's such an abundance of quality in the team. Raheem Sterling, my goodness, you know? If Sterling takes that chance against Lyon, does City have a chance to win the Champions League? I mean, I think so, right? As absurd as it is to say, because their strengths would directly counter Bayern's weaknesses. So they're such a good team. I mean, Will said it. They're always favourites for everything because they're just a phenomenal team. They have these sort of little mental implosions every now and again, which usually cost them in cup competitions. But over a 38-game league season, it would take something spectacularly wrong, as we saw last season, where they just kept making defensive mistakes, unforced mistakes. It was never They've been really outfoxed. It was just doing stupid things like giving the ball away, being far too comfortable in possession in the middle of the pitch rather than in the end of the pitch.
The stats you've mentioned in terms of Man City's metric dominance since Pep Guardiola is certainly impressive. There's always that sort of thing in the back of your mind where a lot of those may be accumulated in specific fixtures. If you think about how many times they hammer a team and yet they will lose to Southampton having that many shots. As you said, over a course of a season, it's likely that you don't keep getting those games where you have 26 shots and don't score. That's why they've fallen out of the Champions League, and Sterling's miss was perhaps his biggest miss of the season after the first time he'd scored 30 goals. So it was saying that Liverpool, the joke about Liverpool being lucky, Man City always seemed to be unlucky, but
yeah,
how often are you unlucky through cause of your own fault is sort of the question that interests me, and how dominant really are they? I saw a discussion of game state and expected goals, which was looking at the fact that when Liverpool were taking the lead, they weren't really adding that much to it. They were just winning the games. Whereas when Man City beat a team, they usually absolutely pummel them.
Yeah.
So those metrics can be inflated there. And maybe that's, again, why we see Man City as favourites, because looking at it, you're like, wow, they had over 100 expected goals last season. I'm pretty sure it was that, or something bonkers like that.
And it but when they're it good, they're very good. Their bottom level is like their bottom level is like a 4 out of 10, a 3 out of 10. Liverpool's bottom level last season in particular was like a 7. They never really played worse than that. And you know, even when they lost to Watford, they weren't like terrible. They just got unlucky.
I think they were quite bad in that game.
I can't remember it, to be honest. So maybe. But that's the point, though, isn't it? They for so long, even when they played poorly, it was never really bad. It was like, okay. Whereas City can oscillate between a 9 out of 10 and a 2. You know, they can be awful. And I think that's the problem. But I think signing someone like Ake, possibly signing Koulibaly, I think that's going to help them then. I think Ferran Torres is an underrated thing, because he'll be a lot of X factor off the bench, which sometimes they lacked last season. They couldn't change things. If they went down, they couldn't really get back, you know?
I think Man City's... I disagree a bit, because I think Man City's bench was a joke usually last season, with Riyad Mahrez being one of the top assisters and not really starting that much. But we'll move on complete squad depth comparisons.
Surely they got Messi, eh?
Yeah, you alluded to the fact you think they're going to be Premier League champions.
Yeah, I would add a caveat. If Thiago goes to Liverpool, that's going to be a close race.
Sam, we haven't heard from you on the title race just yet. So who do you think's going to win based on what you've heard from Will and Mo there?
Yeah, I think it's going to be City. Liverpool struggling to get out of their silk pyjamas.
That's your favourite analogy. You're going to keep referencing that now.
I'm running out of pyjama analogies already.
Yeah. And Will, we didn't really get an answer, I don't think, from you, so I'm going to put you under pressure, and whether you think that everyone's being unfair on poor old Liverpool.
Well, I think what I was really arguing against is how people don't... There seems to be a perception that Liverpool are going to fall off almost dramatically. And I'm kind of basing that impression off the replies to a tweet we did yesterday on our Liverpool predictions article, I think it was, and it had a graphic of Liverpool's squad depth. And the question was, will they win the title? I would lean towards Man City for Sam's pyjama-based reason. But I think it will be closer than some are suggesting it will be. I don't expect a decline from Liverpool, a dramatic decline at least.
Yeah, that squad depth one is one that we prepared for William Hill as well. And we included Thiago and Wijnaldum in it, but perhaps it's going to be a case of only one of those existing. But for what it's worth as well, I think Man City, despite me playing devil's advocate to Mo, I'm worried for Liverpool if Van Dijk were to get injured, or if Mane were to get injured, or if Salah were to get injured. And I think given the amount of football they've played, because they've been so consistent and they're going to play in an extremely busy schedule, I think Man City have more... If it happens to one of their players, they have better options to come and fill in. So moving ourselves down the table, We're going to talk about the fact that the Premier League seems to be a funny old competition these days, in that 20 teams play 38 games each, and at the end of it all, the big six end up filling the top four spots. We had Brendan Rodgers Leicester last season right until the last few weeks, providing us hope that they might break that vice grip, but they ultimately fell short because of losing pretty much every key player apart from Jamie Vardy. So Sam, we've heard from Will on Mo on the title challenges. I wanted to come to you on this and ask, which clubs do you think have the best chance of finishing in the top four in the 2020-21 Premier League season? That is going to trip so many people up this season.
Yeah, so as we've discussed, it's very much a two-horse race for the title. So with minimal risk of getting egg on my face, I think we can safely say that Man City and Liverpool are in the top four with odds of 1-33 and 1-12. They are absolutely nailed on. But beyond that, we've got to look at Chelsea. They've pulled everyone's pants down really in the transfer market this summer. Three starter-worthy forwards in Ziyech, Werner and Havertz. Chilwell, another great addition, albeit a bit expensive, but then we've come to expect that really from English players. And then Thiago Silva, the other one, to help bring on some of their young centre-backs, because I think their centre-backs were often quoted as a bit of a problem position for them last season, but they do have big potential, and having someone like Silva alongside them is only going to boost their credentials and their development. Lampard's got some outrageous attacking options on his hands now. I was looking at some of the sort of 11s that they could play, and I think that 4-3-3 will probably be his best, with Kovacic, Kante and Havertz in a midfield three, and then Ziyech on the right, Pulisic on the left, and then Werner through the middle. I think of all the players they've signed, Werner excites me the most, ice cold in front of goal. I can't wait to be watching him on a regular basis. But what Chelsea are going to be facing this season is a new narrative. Last season, with their transfer ban, they were often billed as the plucky underdogs, which we were guilty of on Squawker. They almost, I think we even labelled them likeable at one point. But I think that sense of goodwill is going to be gone this season. They're back to being big bad Chelsea, who've outspent everyone, splashed the cash. So I think with that, it will not only bring a change in the way that media and fans perceive them, it will also bring a change to Lampard's approach, because he's got a very different dressing room on his hands now. Trusted heads like Willian and Pedro are gone, and the youngsters that he sold the dream to last season might not be as on board when he's telling them that they're on the bench this time around. So players like Mount, Abraham, Loftus-Cheek could be thinking, where's the faith that you put in me last season? Of course, if they embrace that challenge and you end up having everyone pulling in the same direction, fighting for spots and breeding a really competitive environment, then happy days. But it's a very different challenge for Lampard, and I think he's going to be having a lot of people knocking on his door after he makes his team selections this season.
That is a extremely cynical outlook on Frank Lampard and Chelsea's project that was billed as a youth revolution.
Would you expect anything less?
No, but I'm just quite sort of pleased that you were that sort of against it. Because from my point of view, it's pure excitement, I think, because not only were those young players that he trusted last season brilliant, I thought Mason Mount nominated for PFA Young Player of the Season, and was actually, bizarrely, in my opinion, a player that divided opinion among Chelsea fans and football fans in general in terms of how good he actually was. But it was his first ever season in the Premier League, and I think he acquitted himself brilliantly. The fact that they've bought in Havertz, Werner, Pulisic, who didn't actually play that often last season due to injury and it being his first season at the club as well. This season, we should be expecting someone that spends that amount of money and buys the caliber of player they have. You were saying that Man City and Liverpool are locked on. I think if Chelsea don't finish third, that would be disappointing, based on the fact that they were good last season. And again, in terms of those deep metrics that we like to talk about, if Kepa weren't in goal, they would have conceded fewer goals. So their defence in general wasn't great, but it wasn't bad. It was just the fact that, for whatever reason, Kepa's performance in goal was really substandard. And in terms of goals prevented, which uses expected goals versus goals conceded, he was the worst goalkeeper in the Premier League. So objectively, through statistics, they had the worst goalkeeper. I know they've been linked with Mendy from Ligue 1, and maybe he replaces Kepa. And even if he's not brilliant, as long as he is better than Kepa, they should lock in that third place, which they nearly did anyway. And what you said about their starting 11 there, I think there's so many things they can do with the players they've signed. The 4-3-3 that you mentioned, which could also be a sort of 4-2-3-1, sounds like the best pick. And you nailed on what I think their starting 11 will be. But one particular area I wanted to focus on was the fact that you mentioned Conte as someone that should start. And while I appreciate Jorginho and what he does, I think Kovacic and Conte is one of the best double pivots you could have in the Premier League. And if they trust Reece James, which I know I always peddle that agenda on these podcasts, mainly because Azpilicueta is such a loyal servant and still so good, it's difficult to drop him completely. But in Reece James and Hakim Ziyech, they have players who are fantastic at crossing the ball. They're both going to be playing on the right-hand side and they'll be looking to get really far forward. So if you have Conte as the right double pivot in that 4-2-3-1, rather than Jorginho, who is brilliant at progressing the ball forward, you're ensuring that Reece James and Ziyech aren't punished for being completely offensive-minded, because you've got one of the best, and although he was injured last season, he still is one of the best readers of the game and ball winners in the world. So having Conte, Reece James and Hakim Ziyech on one side could give Chelsea one of the best right-hand sides in Europe, I think. And I think that's where Lampard should be building his squad around, because then you've got Werner and Pulisic who are coming in from the left to finish the chances, as well as Abraham and Giroud as brilliant options off the bench.
Not to be completely utterly predictable, but that does remind me actually of Barcelona in 2015, what the lineup you're describing, when they had even Rakitic coming in to replace Xavi. Obviously Rakitic nowhere near the pass and nowhere near the ball dominator that Xavi was, but he was much more physically and tactically responsible defensively, and that allowed Dani Alves and Leo Messi to dominate and lead Barca to a treble. Now again, I'm not saying Ziyech and Reece James is Dani Alves and Leo Messi, but it's a similar sort of profile, right? You've got your number 10 / right winger left footy coming in, you've got your right back bombing on, getting involved in the creative aspect. So I think Kante, that makes a lot of sense to me, with Kante working as a counterweight to those two in particular. So rather than thinking of Jorginho because he's a great passer, you think of the team as a whole and you bring in Kante as a counterweight, could lead Chelsea to a lot of successes.
You said you didn't want to be predictable, but for anyone that hadn't listened in a while, it would not be a Squawker Talker podcast without some reference to some iteration of Barcelona. So it's good that you've stayed true to your brand after all this time.
Another option would be a 3-5-2 with James and Chil on the left, and then with Werner and Havertz up top. But again, not to be too pessimistic for the youth side of things, but then that's another formation that you can't see Hudson-Odoi getting any minutes in. So yeah, Lampard's got a lot of options, but I think with those options, he's going to have some difficult conversations with players who he was putting his full faith in last season.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see whether they all buy into, I think you mentioned it in your first bit, whether they all buy into the fact that they've created this monster attacking squad, or whether people are going to be selfish to an extent and think, well, I was playing 40 games last season and I've played 20 this season. For sure, I think we can expect a lot of goals from Chelsea, and I'm really, really intrigued to see how Werner and Ziyech get on, because they are two players that everyone has been saying their club should sign for the past two seasons, really. And Chelsea have finally done it. And we're seeing both in the same team, which is an even more sort of mouth-watering prospect. Move on from Chelsea, and if we're considering them, that they should be locking in a top four spot. And in terms of odds, excluding Man City, Liverpool and Chelsea for the top four, Man United are next, 4-9, Arsenal 5-2, Spurs 7-2, Wolves 13-2, Leicester 15-2, Everton 16-1, and then Leeds and Southampton at 25-1.
Yeah, so I think Man United are going to get top four. Which will mean, if Chelsea and Man United both secure top four, then it will be the first time since the 2007-2008 and the 2008-2009 season that the top four has stayed the same for two consecutive seasons. Now, I've had a bit of a change of heart with Man United. I've been a fierce critic of them in the past. but the way they finished last season was really impressive. And with Pogba staying, potentially Sancho to come in, and Fernandes, who I originally said would not hit the ground running in January, was probably the worst shout I've ever made.
Sam, it's been six months. You don't need to be this honest.
Yeah, no one remembers anything, man. Just pretend it didn't happen.
So I think they're going to be looking really good in an attacking sense. And I'm a big fan of Van de Beek as well. I think out of that Ajax team, he was my favourite player. Sorry, Mo, I know you're about to launch a Frankie de Jong tirade on me.
No, I like Donny van de Beek. He's great.
He's just not as good, though.
Yeah. I don't think Man United are going to improve dramatically, but I just don't see anyone else doing it either. I don't think there's... So Spurs have gone down the Premier League experience route with their signings, Doherty, Højbjerg and Hart. Same goes for Arsenal's dealings, I would say. Although Arteta, he's restored a real sense of belief within the club, but also outside of it, that Arsenal can compete and step up to the plate against the biggest teams, as we saw in the FA Cup last season. But over the course of a full season, I'm not convinced by Arsenal. I can still see them being too hot and cold. Although with Aubameyang, they're always going to have a chance if he signs the team.
Yeah, that's still not been confirmed yet. Just quickly on Arsenal before I go to you, Mo, to join in on the conversation. Arsenal have been phenomenal under Mikel Arteta at playing against the big teams, which hasn't been said about an Arsenal team for years. They just can't play against the bad teams. And although Mikel Arteta has found a formula to sit in tight and be defensively organised and also be much more effective in transition using that 3-4-3 formation, Arsenal still lost to Aston Villa during the second phase of the season, and they still struggled to score goals against teams that sat deep against them. So Willian is a creative player that has been added to the squad, perhaps underrated at Chelsea, but I also don't think he's a game-changing signing. And Dani Ceballos being secured for Arsenal was something they needed to do massively, because if he weren't to stay, they did not have a midfield. And I still think they lack that creative spark, because we don't know what's going to happen with Mesut Ozil to actually secure a top four finish, despite the fact that in the big games under Mikel Arteta, they've looked much better. The goals they're scoring, passing out the back, are brilliant. That's all really positive, but I still think it needs a full season under Arteta, as well as more intelligent purchases in departments that are lacking for them to be a top four favourite. But given how crazy the league's been and the fact that there are a lot of teams that are probably of a similar standard, the fact that they are now better against the big teams could give them a better chance, although I don't see it myself.
Yeah, no, my point about Arsenal was just going to be that they have the third best coach in the league, as far as I'm concerned. I think he's brilliant. I think he's an absolutely sensational coach. The squad needs a lot of work. Like you say, there's still holes in there. I don't think the squad is quite there yet to finish third. But I think Arteta's a fabulous coach. And I think just the way that Arsenal played since he took charge, the night and day. But with regards to United and Chelsea were basically even last season, but Chelsea have gone and done some excellent business in the window. And whereas United, I mean, Donny van de Beek, great player, like him a lot, but he was attacking midfielder was their lowest priority of signings. It wasn't that they didn't need to sign one. They needed to sign one, but they needed a right winger more, needed a left back more, needed a centre back more, and they've signed none of those players. So how United finish the season, again, we say this every summer, it depends on what they do in the window. Depends on if they get the players in. I mean, Jadon Sancho, is he coming? Is he not? Goodness only knows. You know, who's their left back? Who's their centre back now? They were rumoured to be linked with Gabriel, right? And then he went to Arsenal. So Ake went to Man City. Koulibaly is probably going Man City. So who's their centre back? If they sign one of those, they sign a left back. You know, I mean, the link with Alex Telles, right? Recently, and Sergio Reguilón. So if they get one of those two in, that's very good. But they still need a left back and a right wing. I mean, without Jadon Sancho, they're relying on an 18-year-old playing basically the whole season, because their backups to those front three right now are incredibly substandard.
So, yeah, like we said with Liverpool in terms of depth, Man United, I think they named the same 11 five times in a row for the first time in a long, long while. Yeah. And it was that really solid Fernandes, Matic, Pogba, Martial, Rashford, Greenwood. That on paper is fantastic. They scored so many great goals using that. But you cannot play those five players 38 games in a row all at once.
No, you can't. And
the players that were coming on were maybe not living up to the same standards. So we've still got a month of the transfer window.
Exactly.
That's the thing, is we don't know at all. But as we're doing this at the start of the season, if everything were to stay really similar, I think they're also lacking further options, which leads me on to the bit I've been assigned, and I didn't assign this to myself. It's a group effort, but I was going to discuss a few of the teams that we could maybe consider to be the favourites to gatecrash that top four. And I wanted to start with Everton because, spoiler alert, I don't think it's them, but they've just made three midfield signings within 3 days that have transformed their squad depth, as we're saying. And it's likely that all three players will start. In James Rodriguez, they've signed one of the most popular players in the world. And despite the fact that he hasn't played regularly for a long time, whenever he does play, his goals and assists, the most basic numbers and the most important numbers, are always stupendous. So,
especially under Carlo.
Exactly. His best ever season in terms of goals and assists in a top five league came under Ancelotti. Despite being 5 years ago, it's still something that you can cling to because Ancelotti has worked with him before. He's also worked with Alan before, who was a tackle machine anyway, even under Maurizio Sarri. But in Carlo Ancelotti's season, he made the most tackles in European competition, at least 15 more than anyone. So Ancelotti knows what he wants from James Rodriguez. He knows what he wants from Alan. And Abdoulaye Doucouré is a player that, when he was breaking through at Watford, people were linking him to the top four clubs because of his dynamism, the box-to-box nature he has, the fact that he can play deeper, the fact that Nigel Pearson played him as like a modern number 10 during Watford's brief renaissance towards the second phase of the season. So Everton had a bad midfield and they've added to it, which on paper, again, is important. In Richarlison, they have one of my favourite players in the league, full stop. I think he's a hugely talented player that can only get better. And one of the most interesting things about him, he was the only player in the Premier League last season that had 20 shots with his right foot, his left foot and his head. So they have a versatile shooter if he is not necessarily prolific just yet. And we mentioned 3-5-2 with Chelsea there. And my prediction is that the team that will finish in that fourth spot will be the team that can best implement a 3-5-2 or variant system. I'm not sure why I started thinking about it or if there is much reason behind it, but I think 3-5-2/3-4-1/2/3-4-2-1, that sort of formation is going to be really big again this season, mainly because we've seen the classic number 10 drift away because there's been a greater emphasis on transition football, and the 3-5-2 allows you to do that. It lets you get from back to front quicker and have more players in the box when you do that. And although Everton may not play it, they have a perfect squad for doing it, because in Lucas Digne, he was third behind Kevin De Bruyne and Trent Alexander-Arnold individually for crosses last season. Everton themselves were fifth for crosses and passes into the box in 2019-20. And if he's given full rein as a left wing back, Everton have really dynamic, creative players to fill those wing back spots. Their back three is questionable, but if they can keep Mina, Holgate and Keane all fit, that's quite a nice back three. And you also have Yerry Mina's incredible prowess from set pieces, which Lucas Digne will be taking.
The best defender in the world.
Yeah. Again, for Mo to be predictable, that had to be said. So I'm just thinking that Everton, if they play this 3-5-2, Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison up front, crosses into the box. You've got Calvert-Lewin, who is incredible in the air. You've got Richarlison, who can shoot with any part of his body. So if they can implement that sort of style with Alan and Doucouré and James Rodriguez in front as the midfield three, that to me on paper sounds incredibly interesting. But to link back to my point about 3-5-2, there is a team in the Premier League that already does it perfectly, or at least 3-4-3 and sometimes 3-5-2. Although Sheffield United got a lot of plaudits for the way they implemented that style under Chris Wilder with the overlapping centre-backs and Baldock and Ender Stevens being two of the best wing-backs in the league last season as well, I just don't think they have the strength in depth to get a top four place. But Wolverhampton Wanderers last season played 59 games in a period of 384 days. Despite getting their best ever points tally in the Premier League, they do not have European competition next season because of goal difference, finishing behind Spurs and Arsenal winning the FA Cup. If everyone remembers Antonio Conte played 3-4-3 and won the Premier League title in his first season, having pretty much one game a week. I've got a sneaking suspicion that Wolves can actually break the top four based on the fact that they have one of the best centre forwards in Raúl Jiménez. They have a game-breaking winger in Adama Traoré. They have a brilliant midfield pivot in João Moutinho and Ruben Neves. And they got their most amount of points last season, despite making the second fewest subs in the Premier League, whilst also playing 59 games. Now that Nuno Espirito Santo has complete freedom to use the exact same team every week with no real fitness pressures, I think at 13-2 to finish in the top four, they would be my pick as the outsider to break the top four, because I think they know exactly how they want to play. They have brilliant players that know how to play it, whereas the other teams aren't quite at that level.
If you look back to how they started the 2019-20 season as well, I think in the month of August, they played like five European qualifiers. As you've obviously referred to, their season started super early. It actually took them six Premier League games to get their first win. And I think they finished like, what, 6 points, 5 points away from the top four? But yeah, I mean, it's their slow start that cost them. And they don't have that same issue of having to juggle the Europa League qualifiers this season.
Whereas Spurs have swapped positions with them, and they'll be playing those one-off qualifiers, and they've got to play three in a row. I think it's their October schedule that looks crazy, as well as September anyway. So I think that may count against Spurs. Although one thing that I've been wrestling with, and again, we've not spoken in 6 months, so you're getting takes that have been produced in the depths of my sort of self-isolation. But Son Heung-min is one of the best players in the Premier League. And
agreed.
We saw it a bit when Harry Kane was injured. Harry Kane is now back. And to just peddle this 3-5-2 thing that I don't know why I'm obsessing over it. If Spurs play Kane and Son as the two in a 3-5-2, that is super exciting to me. So that might give Spurs a really good platform to win games by just having two elite forwards on the pitch at the same time. It's just whether they were ravaged by injury last season. So whether that happens again with their increased schedule, it might be the same story. But in terms of individual players that they can put on the pitch in a best case scenario, Spurs have one of the best starting 11s. And that was always said under Maurizio Pochettino as well. So I think Everton have made too many signings for them to gel immediately, but they have the potential to be strong. Wolves, I think, have brilliant players and a system that's been coached into them, and they can play with their eyes closed. Arsenal don't have enough creativity. Spurs, maybe not a deep enough squad. Leicester, it's really difficult because they tailed off loads, but that was due to injuries. So depending who they sign and who comes back, they could make a challenge for it again. And Southampton, who will, I think you mentioned last season as a potential dark horse, and they ended up making that prediction seem quite good, I think, based on their sort of second half of the season form. I actually think they are going to be really good this season as well. So it's so difficult to predict, but Wolves would be my choice. Sam, do you have a choice for an outsider?
I don't think they necessarily get top four, but I just wanted to touch on Sheffield United and some of the business that they've done when you mentioned about their squad depth. I think bringing in Bogle and Lowe from Derby are both really, really shrewd signings. Chris Wilder never shops too far from home. He always goes back into the Championship to make his purchases. And I think that those two will put real pressure on Baldock and Stevens in the wing-back positions. So I think Sheffield United have done really well this summer, and they're sort of building quite nicely without straying too far away from what he knows. The same with Ampadu as well. That's another nice one to bring on loan. And then also Ramsdale, because that was a big question mark with Henderson going back to Man United. And they've nipped that in the bud, that potential problem, by bringing in who could potentially become a £50 million plus player with one good season under his belt.
There it is. I was going to say for any new listeners again, is Aaron Ramsdale is one of Sam's favourite goalkeepers.
All I'm saying is 22, starting for a team that could be in the top six, Euros place in the offing.
It could happen.
Well in with a shout at the Euros place now. Henderson's going to be sitting on the bench behind De Gea.
Or is he?
Moving from the top end of the table straight to the bottom of it, Only once have all three newly promoted sides been relegated in a single season. That was 1997-98. And only three times have all newly promoted teams stayed up, which is 2001-02, 2011-12, and 2017-18. Which means that we can expect a mixture of established and newcomers to maybe be fighting for the drop this season. And we're going to be discussing both. Will, I'm going to come to you, and I want to ask you which Premier League team and established in sort of air quote marks are you most concerned about maybe getting relegated this season?
I actually came round on them during the course of my research for reasons that I'll finish my bit on. But I picked Crystal Palace to look into because they were, excluding Norwich, the Premier League's worst post-restart team. They beat Bournemouth in their first game back and drew with Spurs on the final day. But they lost all seven games in between those two fixtures, scoring twice and conceding 17 times. And anyway, I also picked Palace because I saw a while back that they have the oldest squad in the league. That was according to Smarter Scout, which is a product we did a bit of work with earlier in the year. They put their average squad age, which is weighted for playing time, at 29.8 years old. And on top of that, Roy Hodgson is known to like a settled starting 11. Palace are also one of only three Premier League teams to use fewer than 100 substitutions last season. And given the lack of interval between last season and 2020-21, fitness is an issue you would expect to come to the fore. And if you have a player, if you have a team of players pushing 30 or in their 30s, managed by a guy who likes to be consistent with his selections, is perhaps even a little averse to making in-game changes too, you could expect to have trouble. And they haven't actually been given a great head start because according to the Premier League injury table on premierinjuries.com, no Premier League team has more absentees than Palace right now. They start the season with seven. They start the season without return dates even for the likes of Patrick Van Aanholt, Gary Cahill, Mamadou Sakho. A couple of those are long-term absentees, but they're also teams that would be in the reckoning for their first-choice back line. Their opening run of games is pretty tough. The most winnable ones, Brighton, which is, of course, a derby for them. They started on Southampton, then they play Man United, Everton and Chelsea. And then the other main reason is they scored just 31 goals in the Premier League last season, which is their lowest in any league season in the club's history, apparently, and across four of Europe's top five leagues, because I excluded Ligue 1, because obviously they finished their season and didn't resume it. Only four teams scored fewer, and they were all relegated.
I know I didn't do a bit, but to give you confidence, even though I think you're now going to tell us why you said you went back on it, Crystal Palace would have been my call, because I think I went for them last season. They just don't score any goals. And although Eze is a really exciting signing, and the prospect of Zaha on one wing and Eze on the other, you've got two prolific dribblers that can create something out of nothing, you still just don't know if they're going to score goals based on how Roy Hodgson sets up, defend first and then score later, and as well the players that they have around them.
Oh, by the way, I think Eze's picked up an injury, by the way.
Oh, there you go then.
So I don't know if it's that serious, but I think based on the formation that Roy Hodgson's played in those games and across some of the final games of the Premier League, it might be more of a 4-4-2 they switched to, with Eze playing like left wing and then Zaha is like the left forward, or some kind of variation of like two wingers and then two sort of forwards closer to the middle.
Yeah, Van Aanholt, Eze and Zaha would be a really quite a fun left-hand side. They just might have to do everything down that side.
To recap, the issues that Palace have to worry about is they have the oldest team in the league, ended last season badly, and as its second from bottom goalscorers. They address some of these issues in what has been a pretty decent transfer window so far. Nathan Ferguson is a young guy they can develop and eventually settle him in one of the defensive positions, be that right back, where they haven't really replaced Aaron Wan-Bissaka, or in central defence. I think that's his natural position, but who knows where he'll end up. And then Eze is the other one, 22-year-old left-sided attacker, cost them $20 million from QPR. He scored 14 championship goals last season and assisted another eight. So he was QPR's top goalscorer and their joint leading assists maker. And yeah, that could create quite a nice little forward line where you have Zaha and potentially Ayew, or if they get the signing of Mishi Batshuayi through on loan from Chelsea, then potentially him. He scored seven goals in 13 games for them in the second half of the 2018-19 season, five in 11 league appearances alone. And then obviously with Eze potentially on the left, on the other side, you've got Townsend, maybe Ayew there as well. It seems like a forward line that you would expect more than 31 goals from.
It's the classic too good to go down front line.
Yeah, and there's the other question, is that the forward front four I listed just sounds a bit out of character with Roy Hodgson, whose two main strikers pretty much did more defending than they did attacking last season. The Premier League forward who won possession more times than any other last season was Willian, but Wilfried Zaha is second in that metric, and Jordan Ayew is fourth. Christian Benteke is more of a backup who occasionally plays as a lone striker, but he isn't known for his goal scoring output these days, of course. But what he does do, or what he seems to do more than anyone else in the league, is win aerial duels. I think he won more per 90 minutes than any other Premier League player last season. So he's there kind of for his hold-up play and just to kind of, you know, keep the ball as far away from Palace's goal as possible. And then lastly, to come back to the reason I actually initially looked into them, which was that losing streak that I mentioned right at the top. It started when they were already safe. And if you look at the teams they lost to, Liverpool beat them 4-0 in a game that ultimately won the title. So their last competitive game of the league season. And they otherwise lost to three teams competing for the Champions League football, which were Leicester, Chelsea and Manchester United, and a relegation threatened Aston Villa. So it would have been difficult for them to match the motivation levels of five of their seven final opponents. The other teams that beat them were Wolves, who we've tipped to be a dark horse for top four, and Burnley, who, if memory serves, were quite impressive in the post-restart. They obviously picked up a point from Liverpool. Yeah.
Well, the only team to win a point at Anfield, weren't they, in the whole season?
But yeah, so in terms of established Premier League sides, I would be most worried about, after having looked into all this, I would probably revise the answer to Newcastle, who had the worst XG difference in the division last season. Although they have optimism in the fact that they've just signed Jamal Lewis, who was a Liverpool target. The Ryan Fraser-Callum Wilson partnership that, according to Opta Joe, combined for the second most goals ever in a single Premier League season in 2018-19 with 12, which is behind only Alan Shearer and Chris Sutton, the SAS Blackburn title-winning partnership.
So they've pre-bought some in-game synergy if they can fit them into the side. Mo, do you share Will's thoughts on teams you are worried about that are established, not newly promoted, being relegated?
No, for the simple reason that for me, the obvious candidate to go down of the established teams is West Ham. To face relegation trouble is West Ham, because they're so bad. They're so bad, guys. They've signed no one this season in the summer already. They've brought Souček in, but they had him already last season. They finished just 5 points off relegation, and they haven't really added to the squad. They got slumped 5-3 by Bournemouth in pre-season, so they're not even coming in like good form. They had just 7 clean sheets last season. Only Norwich and Bournemouth had less. And of those 7, only 2 of them have come in 2020. So they've been leaking goals for fun. 62 conceded. Only Villa and the relegated sides conceded more. They're not good. Moyes worked his miracle, but really Moyes' miracle was getting Mikel Antonio into position to have this incredible run to the end of the season. He had 2 goals coming into the restart, and then he scored 8 goals in 9 games and basically kept them up, because he was everything. If he didn't light up like he did, West Ham go down. And it wasn't like they steamrolled everyone. It wasn't like Wigan back in the day when they had their great escape. It was just they won enough games to stay up. And if Antonio doesn't take flight the way he does, I mean, you know, I know Jared Bowen's in the squad and he's a good player, and you'd imagine they'll get more out of him.
Yeah, I think the other reason that we always discuss about West Ham is the sort of toxic feeling around the club, which has clearly come in with Dean Garner being sold. And the fans are just so frustrated that sort of dream that they've been sold by Sullivan and Gold 5 years down the line, they're still sanctioning the sales of youth players to raise funds, underbidding for Burnley's players and struggling to make the signings that they need ahead of a new season. Yeah, I think it's going to be another difficult one for West Ham, because the fans are not happy again, and they seem like they're pulling in completely different directions before a ball has even been kicked.
I mean, yeah, Alaire scored 7 goals last season, so there's always a chance he could have a much better season this year. But I don't know, Moyes' strength is coming in when everyone's down, and everyone's like, oh no, we're going to get relegated. And he gives them a bit of confidence. He stiffens them up a little bit at the back, not much. And then it just gives them enough confidence to sort of get out there and do the bare minimum to survive, which is what he's done 2 times now. So yeah, I just think I can't see past West Ham going down, man. Sorry, West Ham.
If we've got Crystal Palace, Newcastle and West Ham as maybe the 3 most likely established Premier League teams to be relegated. Let's discuss the newly promoted sides and which one may finish higher, whether all of them are outside the relegation zone or not. Sam, I'm going to come to you first on this, as maybe I've heard whispers of Scott Parker fanboyism creeping in, but is there enough room alongside Harry Kane in your heart?
No more room for anyone but Harry Kane in my heart, mate. But I was going to start this just looking at at William Hill's top half finish odds. And the question of which promoted team is going to finish highest, looking at those, there's only one answer, and that's Leeds, who are 2-1 to finish top half. West Brom 8-1, and then Fulham 9-1, which is longest odds in the division. So looking tough for Fulham. The bookies clearly fancy Bielsa Ball to go up another gear in the Premier League. And I think it's easy to see why when you think all the way back to January when they played Arsenal in the FA Cup. For that opening 45 minutes, they looked every inch a Premier League club. As is always the way, when you get promoted, if you've got a key core group of players, a defined playing style and a settled squad, then in theory, picking up where you left off and hitting the ground running seems to be an achievable target. Leeds definitely have all three of those and will have the beating of the majority of teams in the lower reaches of the table, purely because there's not much between the top six in the Championship and the bottom six in the Premier League. But I feel like there's quite a lot of talk that it's almost a given for Leeds that they are going to hit the ground running and finish top half. But I don't think we should forget that Bielsa, who clearly has his disciples, he hasn't managed, I think I'm right in saying, a top flight campaign in its entirety since 2014-15. And if he hated his media commitments in the Championship, then the Leeds comms teams have got a hell of a job to keep him onside for the mammoth media attention that he's going to get, because everything's going to be billed as Bielsa versus Guardiola, Bielsa versus Lampard. They were clearly the story in the Championship, and I can't think of another team that's come up and will immediately demand such a big chunk of the story in the Premier League as Leeds, because they are certainly going to be one of the most talked about teams, even though they are newly promoted. And I don't think that's going to work in their favour, really, having that extra scrutiny brings added pressure. And I don't think that will suit them.
I mean, it's Leeds, isn't it, though? That's one of the reasons. I mean, yeah, Bielsa's a big reason, but it's Leeds. They're finally back. I mean, this was, when did they get relegated? 2004 was forever ago. They've been in the wilderness for years, and now they're finally back. And then Bielsa is just absolutely magic. And the one thing, the reason why I'm quietly confident about, I don't know if they're going to finish top four European places or anything, but I'm quietly confident about them, because if you look at what we saw last season with Sheffield United, a system allowed them to do much better than you would look at their players and think, there's no way. We all thought they were going to get relegated. And Bielsa has a system. It's a physically demanding system, but he has a system. And I think that is going to automatically give him an edge, as you say, Sam, over the bottom half of the table, probably. Rodrigo is a bit of a similar player in profile to what they already have, but he's better. He's a Champions League level player. He's been playing in the Champions League, playing in the Europa League. He's a top quality player. Bielsa is just, he's brilliant, but I do think they'll fizzle out. I think more likely what will happen is they'll start strong, and then by March or February or March, they'll just start losing games, loads and loads, because they'll just be too physically shattered. But I do think a good mid-table position is reasonable for Leeds.
I was going to come in on this and say that if we were saying which one was going to finish higher, it's like the popular thing to say, but Leeds United, they seem to be like the team that are going to do it, because underlying metrics, they had the most shots in the Championship, they had the highest expected goals, fewest expected goals conceded. But the really interesting thing about Leeds is the fact that they create so many chances, but they underperform massively. They missed 88 big chances last season, which is 28 more than any other side. So despite the fact that they had the highest expected goals by at least 12, they weren't the division's top scorers. And the main reason for this is because Patrick Bamford has become infamous for his inability to score as many goals as he should based on the chances he gets. Essentially, one of the most criminal XG underperformers that you'll find in Europe. His stats last season, his expected goals total was 27.5. So based on the shots that he was managing to get in that Leeds side, an average player would be considered to score 27 and a half goals. He did not score 27 goals. And even if you then look at a more advanced metric, which is expected goals on target, which looks at placement of the actual shots, his expected goals drops down to 21, which is still very high, but it suggests that he's just not the elite finisher Leeds would need in the Premier League to mount that challenge towards the top half of the table. And similar to Will in his Crystal Palace story, I was immediately set out on saying Rodrigo's a brilliant signing for the reasons that Mo said. He's Spain's first choice centre forward at the moment. But he is plagued by the same issue as Patrick Bamford, in the sense that in the last two La Liga seasons, he's scored 12 goals, which is fine. He actually has more assists than goals, which again is a really good asset to add to your team. But he was expected to score 20. So he is -8 on his expected goals. And what we usually see in strikers is they actually outperform their expected goals. So to be 8 off, it's not quite as bad as Bamford. But there is this underlying feeling that although Rodrigo is a brilliant player, the man that they need to score goals, and which is what we saw with Norwich, they came up to the Premier League as a really exciting attacking team, scoring so many goals. We thought they were going to be brilliant. Their style of play was excellent, but they didn't score enough. I'm concerned about Leeds not scoring enough, despite the fact that I think they will carve out more chances than Norwich, given their style of play.
I think top half is a stretch, but I think around the 13th, 14th place mark is going to be enough to be the highest place promoted side. We mentioned Scott Parker earlier, and I think that he hasn't had his praises sung as much as perhaps he should have. If you compare the season that he's just had with Fulham compared to the one that Frank Lampard had with Derby. Obviously, Fulham made a lot of headlines last time when they came up signing 12 players, 100 million, which went extremely wrong extremely quickly. So Parker's had to be a bit shrewder this time around. He's also made some surprising decisions as well. I think Harrison Reed coming in on a permanent was important given how big a role he played for them last season. Lamina coming in on loan, I'm not so sure about. And also Knockaert signing permanently, I didn't expect that. His output's been pretty poor for them, and he didn't really tear up too many trees when he was at Brighton in the Premier League either. But the main ones that I was surprised about to see Sessegnon and Mawson both loaned out to Bristol City. I really thought Mawson would be coming back into the side to at least challenge for a starting spot, because their squad's looking a little thin, especially in defence, while an injury to Mitrovic up top would be catastrophic. Although he's 6 mil on fantasy football, he's going to be an excellent option for all your sort of third choice strikers out there when you're trying to penny pinch, because you splurge all your money on Aubameyang. But it does seem that a lot of their eggs will be in Mitrovic's basket. So yeah, I do worry for Fulham. Parker, he clearly wants to dominate possession and dictate the tempo. I think only Leeds had more possession than them in the Championship last season, with around the 60% mark. But I fear it is going to be a slog for them. 26 points they got in 2018-19. And surely they're going to do better than that, because the group that they've got is much tighter knit. But I do fear that Fulham will be going straight back down.
You mentioned Mitrovic there. I'll briefly touch on West Brom, because I think there's a similar narrative there, in the sense that if Mitrovic doesn't play, goals look very rare in that Fulham team. Their business is quite similar to Aston Villa last season, in the sense that they've just secured players they had on loan and made them permanent members of the squad. And those two players that are super important were Grady Diangana, but more importantly was Mateus Pereira, who, just skimming over his stats for last season, provided the most assists in the Championship with 16, created the most chances with 116, and was the only player in the division to break the 100 mark. He also won the most fouls in the division with 114, and had 111 shots. It's that Jack Grealish sort of vibe, in the sense that everything's going to have to go through him, and he may be good enough to carry them just above the relegation zone like Jack Grealish did. But I think the fact that they're so reliant on one player, whereas what we've spoken about with Leeds is the team and the system seems strong, I think it might be a bit too much of an ask in terms of them being the highest place promoted team, but it may be enough to avoid relegation if his star quality is that phenomenal.
I think the other positive thing for West Brom is that they do have quite a strong nucleus of players who have got a lot of Premier League experience amongst them. People like Charlie Austin, Kieran Gibbs, Matty Phillips, Jake Livermore. I don't think they're going to be going into the season under any illusions about how difficult it's going to be.
The major worry was that their top scorers, they had two players with 10 goals, but their top scorer in the Championship was 10. So just to round this section off, a quick fire ranking of the newly promoted teams.
For me, it's going to be Leeds, West Brom and Fulham, but with West Brom and Fulham both going down.
Mo, any thoughts?
Leeds will start mid-table. West Brom will just about survive on like the late in the season, and Fulham are going to go back down. Sorry.
I agree with the order, but I'm not committing to relegation positions because I'm scared.
I think Leeds, West Brom, Fulham. Fulham most likely to go down.
Okay.
I don't think it's going to be as cut and dry as...
We might end up doing the reverse Sheffield United. And this season, everyone said that Leeds, everything points towards them doing really well, whereas Sheffield United were predicted to go down. It would be absolute chaos.
That's the problem. Everyone's scarred by their predictions of Sheffield United going down.
So basically, ignore everything. For the final part of the first Squawker Talker in 6 months, we're going to be rattling through, or at least trying to, the individual award winners for the 2020-21 Premier League season. And there's no better place to start than the Golden Boot and Sam Long, because we know that's a match made in heaven.
Yeah, my new shiny membership card's just come through the post, so I'm sticking with my man Harry Kane.
And is there any other reason apart from blind faith that you're picking him?
I'll go with blind faith.
Fair enough. If he plays that 3-5-2, it's a good shout. Mo, who are you picking?
It's got to be Aubameyang, hasn't it? If he signs the contract, obviously. If he doesn't, then, I mean, I guess
that would be the biggest anti-climax / heartbreaking moment, I think, for the Arsenal fan base. Winning them two trophies and then just leaving. Harry Kane and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang are the joint favourites on William Hill to win the Golden Boot at 5-1 this season. Will, have you gone with the favourites, or do you have something?
No, I went way more left field. After having just watched Jamie Vardy win it, I decided to look a bit further down the odds list, and I picked Raheem Sterling, who finished the season with 9 goals in 9 games, seems to be getting closer to the tip of the pack. And in the last couple of seasons, you haven't really seen a single goal scorer hit those high 30s. It's all kind of been around the 20s. And I think in the season where Pep Guardiola might finally succeed in phasing Sergio Aguero out, it leaves a vacancy for a new top scorer to come to the fore, and that is Raheem Sterling.
If Pep Guardiola finally gets rid of the top scoring foreign player in Premier League history, that pesky player up front, Raheem Sterling seems to be the benefit. And if he didn't have that barren period in 2020, he could have already locked it in. I've not gone left field. I've gone for Aubameyang because I think, similar to the point you've just said there, Will, Arsenal was still actually reliant on one player to score their goals, despite other teams learning to share the load a bit more. So with the perceived improvement under Arteta and the fact that he was one goal away from doing it last season, I think Aubameyang is always a strong shout for scoring goals. It's what he's really, really good at. But preventing goals, Edison picked it up last season for Manchester City, despite them sometimes having some defensive mishaps. Back-to-back Brazilian winners of the Golden Glove. Sam, who do you think is going to pick it up this season?
I'm backing Alisson to do it this season.
Mo?
Dean Henderson.
That's right. That is the worst shout.
That's right.
He's going to struggle from the bench.
Mate, David De Gea is going to be sitting on the bench watching him keep clean sheet after clean sheet. It's going to be it, man.
I'm going to safely say that's the worst shout because he may play, but we don't know if he will. I think Man United goalkeeper, in a general sense, is a decent idea. They were pretty solid last year without actually anyone realising it. So maybe a looser prediction might work well for you. But Dean Henderson fanboyism creeping through like Sam's Harry Kane agenda. Will, who are you going with?
Yeah, I went a bit more tame on this one. I've gone for Alisson. Just assuming that he plays, he doesn't miss as many games as he did during the recent campaign. I think it was like 11 games.
Yeah, I've gone for Alisson as well, because the fact that he missed, as you said, double figures of matches and was still in the top five, still managed 10 clean sheets. If he played the whole season, you would have expected him to win it by a distance. And with Liverpool's defence being so brilliant, I think another Brazilian winner. Who said Brazilians didn't make good goalkeepers?
I would like to point out that I agree that Alisson is the logical choice. I'm just going out there, taking a risk.
You're just being fun.
Being provocative. Yeah.
Gets the people going, as they say. The other individual award that has been dominated by Belgians rather than Brazilians is the Playmaker Award. After your predictions, we'll get the quickfire ones out of the way. You then have to listen to me theorycraft something, and I'll try and be as brief as possible. So, Sam?
Yeah, I've gone for De Bruyne, a bit of recency bias, but I saw the dummy that he sold the entire Iceland defence last night and went with him.
Yeah, Kevin De Bruyne, Player of the Year. He's best player in the division.
Will?
Yeah, Kevin De Bruyne, unless the whoever runs Premier League stats does a number on him again and dorks off his assists.
Managed to get 20, and in his head, I think he had like 26 last season. Chance creation and assists is something that I really find interesting because there's never really a fair metric that backs it up. Goals are obvious, you're scoring them. Whereas if you're creating chances, second assists, people hate. So in this little theory crafting, I've picked out two stats that I think are important when trying to guess who's going to be the most prolific assist provider in the Premier League. I'm going to use expected assists, which is sort of the advanced metric done by Opta, which measures how likely it is an average player would score from the chances being created and passes to a teammate. And I'm going to focus more on, though, is one of my favourite stats at the moment, which is penalty area entries, which sounds fancy like that, but this measures passes that are played into the opposition box. Because although you might not always complete them, a player that's putting the ball in the box the most amount of times surely will pick up a few assists along the way. Last season, for example, Trent Alexander-Arnold played more passes into the box than any other player in Europe's top five leagues, with a quite staggering 509. And of course, we know he provided the second most assists in the Premier League behind De Bruyne with 13, setting a record, breaking his own, for most by a defender in a single season. So he is a player that could be in with a chance, but he's not who I'm going to pick. Kevin De Bruyne played 415 passes into the box, which was the second in Europe, and obviously provided 20 assists. So using penalty area entries to try and work out who might be king of the assists this season. In the Premier League in 2019-20, 21,713 passes were played into the box, and there were 706 Opta-defined assists. So if my maths is correct, which I'm really hoping it is, on average, 30 passes into the box is an assist. Kevin De Bruyne last season averaged an assist every 20 passes into the opposition box, and Trent was one every 39. So the average matches up. Per 90 minutes, it was 14.4 for Trent, and 13.4 for Kevin De Bruyne. They were the only two players with 900 minutes that averaged above 10, and Bruno Fernandes was third with 9.82. However, he's not my pick either. The man that I think, if everything goes as I expect, to be the winner of the Playmaker Award will be Chelsea's new signing, Hakim Ziyech. Since 2017-18 in league and European competition, Ziyech averages 15.6 penalty area entries per 90. And with 1,501 in total and 49 assists, he plays 30 passes into the box per assist, which is exactly the Premier League average we saw last season, suggesting his output is more sustainable. If we look at the Eredivisie season last season alone, which although was cut short, we're using per 90, so we're not looking at the total, he played 17.7 passes into the box per 90 minutes and recorded 12 assists. His expected assists, which I'm using to back up the passes into the box, was 13.3. So he was expected to provide more than he actually did. So to finish it off and prove why I think he will be the playmaker of the year if he plays consistently and is part of that dominating right side that I mentioned earlier in the podcast, using the 2019-20 league season, expected assists per 90, Kevin De Bruyne, the Premier League Playmaker of the Year, 0.47 expected assists per 90 minutes, Trent Alexander-Arnold, 0.27, Hakim Ziyech was both combined at 0.74 expected assists per 90 minutes. Now, you have to consider that it wasn't in the Premier League, he was in a dominant team, but we said that Chelsea could be one of the dominant Premier League teams. And if Ziyech performs as I believe he will perform, and his numbers suggest he will perform, then I think he could break the Belgian monopoly on the Playmaker Award this season. Do people agree that it's at least interesting?
It makes perfect sense to me. Following that logic, yeah, he's a great player. We've always known this. Those numbers back up the eye test that he's a great player. I think it'd be a good shout. It'd be interesting to watch. And you do imagine he'll be the chief creator for that Chelsea team, given that Werner and Havertz like to get in the box and score goals. So, you know, and Mason Mount as well, coming off the bench if he starts, whatever, you know. So there's a lot of goals in that Chelsea team potentially anyway. So
exactly. And not only have Chelsea added the creator that Lampard sort of thought he was missing last season, they've added even more firepower to convert those chances. So it all adds up. And if he provides as many assists as his numbers suggest, he might even be a rogue shout for PFA Player of the Year. But I might be getting ahead of myself. The three players I named in that sort of playmaker award discussion, I think are actually the top three, could be top three contenders. Trent has a really good case because he's popular and is so important to that Liverpool side. De Bruyne is Kevin De Bruyne, as we said, best player. But I think Ziyech could really be a rogue shout for that because I just think he's going to add so much to the Chelsea team. But enough from me, Sam. The final part of the podcast, who do you think is going to be Premier League Player of the Year?
I think it's going to be a Kevin De Bruyne double playmaker and player of the season.
And he is favourite with William Hill after his phenomenal season, 4-1. So the odds are backing you there, Sam. Mo, who do you think?
I think they'll give it to Raheem Sterling, who is City's second best player and who will have a very, very good season. I'm not going to tip him for the Playmaker Award like you did last year, Jake, or the Goalscorer Award like Will did this year. But I'll say he'll get a respectable amount in both, maybe plus 17 in both goals and assists, maybe certainly plus 15. And I think he'll get the Player of the Year.
Will, do you have any differing thoughts on it?
No, mine would be Raheem Sterling. It would be really weird if he won the Golden Boot as I predicted and then didn't win PFA Player of the Year award, so I've got to go with him.
Doubling down. If Bruno Fernandes continues like he did last season, it's hard to argue with goals and assists, even if they are from the penalty spot. So that rounds everything up for our William Hill sponsored 2020-21 Premier League season predictions. Thank you so much for your patience for waiting for another Squawker Talker, and thank you for listening to this podcast. Remember to write our predictions down so that you can make fun of us throughout the season if it starts going wrong, and hopefully we'll be speaking to you again soon.